Hi, friends. This is a really great edition of Homefront. We talk about money, what's happening in California, and even throw in some NFL football talk. I'm going to ask Bill how we are going to get our country back on track, and you're going to love his answers. Welcome to Homefront on Missouri Grassroots Radio. I'm Cynthia Davis, your host. As a writer, speaker, and former legislator, we discuss limiting government, fiscal responsibility, and fair taxation. I'm a mother of seven and a wife of one for over three decades, so I bring you my personal experience. And now it's time for Homefront with Cynthia Davis. Welcome to Homefront. Today we have an impressive guest from the state of California. We have Bill Lucenhide. Bill is a financial advisor and he ran for Congress in 2010. So welcome, Bill.
Cynthia, my pleasure to be with you here on Homefront.
What is it like out there in California?
You mean as far as the weather? as far as the politics are concerned, we're in a lot of trouble. But as far as the weather, we're in a giant heat wave. We've had a remnant of a little hurricane off of Mexico, so we've had record temperatures and record humidity, very unlike California.
You mean it feels like Missouri?
I think it's more like Florida these days.
How funny. So what city are you in?
I live in Menifee, California. It's out here in the Inland Empire, about 60 miles from Los Angeles, in the Southern California area, and it's a growing community out here, suburbia of Orange County, San Diego, and Los Angeles counties.
I have in-laws who live in California, so a part of my heart is there now, although they live more near San Francisco. But nevertheless, despite the efforts to educate and inform the nation, it seems like California is making every decision they can to move further to the left every day. So, and in that regard, I do feel sorry for you, and I offer my condolences.
Well, they call California, what, the land of fruits and nuts. The one thing I'd like your audience to know is that although California is viewed as a very liberal state, and it is definitely a gateway to socialistic ideas and liberal ideas and all that to the entire nation, most of California's landmass is conservative people. If you were to remove Los Angeles County and the San Francisco Bay Area from the equation, you would find that California actually has quite a number of conservative-thinking people, constitutional-loving people, and so forth. But because of the fact that we're talking two-thirds of the population live in these very tiny areas of Los Angeles County and the San Francisco Bay Area, that the entire state kind of gets stained that way. But your agricultural area and your rural mountain areas are actually very conservative in their thinking.
So, Bill, would you advise me to move to California and run for office out there?
We need your help, Cynthia. California is the seventh largest economy in the entire world. In other words, if California was a nation, it would be the seventh largest nation in the world in terms of economic output. So that being the case, California is important not just to the United States, with its breadbasket of the San Joaquin Valley and its oil production technological advances and whatnot. We're important to the entire world. So listen, California, we need to turn it around, not just for the United States, but for the benefit of the entire world.
Well, Bill, you have a website called investmentwarrior.com. What I love about your website is it has a great picture of you, and you're a smart man who knows how to navigate. So tell us a little bit about your connection with money and what started you down this path of wanting to study economy.
Appreciate that question. I'm the president of a registered investment advisory firm. I do mutual fund management and the like for different clients, their IRAs and their 401k rollovers and the like. But what got me interested in money was My father and I were numismatists, that's coin collectors, way back in the 1960s. And my father would take me to the, well, at that time existed, was called the Pacific Stock Exchange, and I'd watch the currency traders and the stock traders and the like, and I was fascinated by it, and I started reading different books. And if you study the history of money, you'll study the history of mankind, and I started learning about money and currency and banking and those type of things, and really at an early age. I was just about 10 years old when I started on this mission, and so just been fascinated by it. But money represents power, and the good Lord in heaven is watching how we manage power in all areas of our life. And money management is certainly a very important power in our life. It is a gateway to understand your personality and your abilities in many, many different ways. And so it's a fascinating thing, and it's an important topic in people's lives because we need to learn how to manage power. And if you cannot manage money, if you're not wise about that and so forth, you're going to be probably deficient in other areas of the managing of power in your life.
That's interesting, because most of Jesus's parables were economic. If you just think about what he was trying to teach us with the parable of the talents and how people invested it, the rich young ruler who asked him for advice, what should I do to inherit eternal life? And he said, sell everything and give it to the poor. There are a lot of teachings on money. As much as some people today into the social elements would like to act like it's all about love, love is it too, but our money is an outside manifestation of what's in our hearts. So explain to us what you can extrapolate about what's happening to America by how we spend our money.
Well, the one thing that God hates is slavery. And slavery is a very much an economic thing. And when you're a slave, you do not have economic freedom. You do not have the ability to possess the power of money and possession of any sort like that. And God hates slavery. That's why we had to have Israel leave Egypt, all right? God does not want people to be beholden to other people and to have these earthly masters, as you will. We are owned by Jesus Christ, and he is our master, and he is the true master. But creating economic slavery will lead to physical slavery. There's just no doubt about that. And our Redeemer has come to declare the acceptable year of the Lord, which was the Jubilee year. The Jubilee year, biblically, was an economic type of thing. The land went back to the original owners. Slaves were freed. There was an economic freedom that occurred with the Jubilee year. Jesus came to preach the acceptable year of the Lord, which was the Jubilee. And so here we are in the United States with long-term economic slavery, indebtedness on the national level, on the state level, and the individual level, corporate level. Debt everywhere. And what does debt equal? Well, where does it always end up? It ends up with slavery, a concept that God is very much against.
I was puzzled by this during my 8 years I was in the Missouri State Legislature. And as many times as I've asked this question, I have never gotten an answer that made sense. But the question is, why should we have debt? And now you may have a great answer, or maybe you can explain it to my guests, or maybe you'll be the first person who can enlighten me in a way that makes sense. But our state has been a state since 1821. That means we've had a lot of time to stabilize ourselves. Now, the typical debt question I always hear is, well, couples have to go into debt to buy a house because if they didn't do that, then they would not have any place to live for the first 45 years of their marriage. Okay, so I get that, but why should any state have to be in debt? And I know the answer because I've asked it enough times. They'll say, well, we can borrow other people's money for cheaper than we can use our own. That still makes no sense. Debt is debt. So Our budget includes money every year for paying off our debts, and I understand the importance of paying our debts. What I don't get is why we have that budget category at all, given that we should be old enough and mature enough to have paid our debts, and now we should be a lender, not a borrower. Can you help enlighten me, Bill?
Well, the bottom line is this. All money is created through the mechanism of debt. It's a very poor system to have wealth being, in effect, created through the mechanism of debt. Every dollar that's in circulation is lent into circulation, and it comes with an interest rate. And, of course, then there's never really enough money to service the debt. If I lent you a dollar, right, and I wanted to, and that's the only dollar that existed anywhere, and I said, I want 10% interest on that. Well, when the year comes up, you owe me $1.10. Well, there's only $1 in existence. Where does the $1.10 come from? Well, I just lend you some more to cover that. And eventually it ends up either in inflation or default or both, and it's a system that cannot work. I've asked this question, we have the quantitative easing and lowering of interest rates and so forth, because we want to stimulate the economy. But we're trying to stimulate the economy through the mechanism of debt. Wouldn't it just be easier if we just lowered the tax rates? In other words, we want money into circulation to improve things. I understand that. Why don't we just reduce the tax rate? And you would say, well, if we do that, the size of government would have to go down, and all the welfare entitlement payments would have to go down. But if the economy was stimulated through the reduction of taxes, employers would have more money to spend. They'd hire more people. The economy would chug along. Those people that are disenfranchised from the entitlement system would have the ability to earn a living. There would be more jobs and more prosperity and so forth. So what we have is we have the intermediaries of government and the banking system that want a piece of the action. They want to act as the casino, if you will, and be the middleman of really a situation they should not be involved in. And so that's the reason why, Cynthia, is you have the debt masters and the debt creators, and there's people that have vested interests in perpetuating that system. And so that's why we have that. And when it comes to young couples and the like, let me tell you, if we can go back to the Bible here for a second, God gives us the admonition that we need to save not just for our children, but for our children's children. There should be an inheritance. That type of thing. We have lost that legacy. It's going to take a brave people to be able to start over and stand up and say, hey, listen, we need to repent of our evil ways. We need to store up for the future, storehouse for the future, and so forth. It means that it's going to take a generational sacrifice to be able to get us back on track. But we must do that, or we're going to find ourselves both economically, intellectually, and spiritually in bondage.
So what you're suggesting is parents and grandparents help their kids get a house instead of having the kids go to the bank?
Well, you know what? Other societies have, you'll notice they'll have multi-generational houses and that type of thing. We just don't seem to have that same type of culture here.
Yeah.
To where, the grandparents are there, and if instead of carting the kids off to a government-sponsored preschool, right, or the like, you have the grandparents can help watch the kids during the day while parents are out working and the like. And there's a large 5-6 bedroom house, and people are taking care of things and the like. And it allows an older generation to stay relevant and to pass on their values and the like. And so what we've done is in our societies in many different ways is we've done a divide and conquer. Family strength, leaders of all types, whether they're in business or in the community or in the religious community, in the family, leadership is being divided and conquered, all right? So that, again, the nanny state can come to the rescue and be the great overlord of people's lives and in society and so forth. So we can learn some lessons from other cultures. I know definitely in the Far East and all that, there's more of a culture of family and family assistance, the ability to go into business together and have the brothers, you know, put some money together to form a business and do that type of thing. We don't do that here. We've lost that tradition.
Have you ever seen anybody driving around with a bumper sticker that says, "I'm spending my children's inheritance"?
I chuckle when I see it. But the idea of, you know, he who has the most toys, you know, that dies with the most toys wins, it's a damnable concept, that's for sure. And our mission in life is to leave a legacy of character, integrity, and faith. That is really what the important legacy is to leave behind for our family and for our nation. And that requires some deferred gratification thinking. It also requires a mindset of long-term thinking, multi-generational thinking, thinking of 100 years out, not just what is that I can get in the immediate next 5 minutes. But we've grown up in the Big Mac generation, where you can have that satisfaction in 30 seconds and instant gratification. And again, that will lead to a downfall of society at all levels if you do not have vision. Bible verse, if you will, when there is no vision, the people will perish. We've got to have vision. It starts as an individual, and it will trickle up to the government. And I'm starting to realize more and more that it's got to start with each of us as individuals, all areas of life when it comes to wisdom. It starts as the individual and it trickles up. The idea of finding, if we can just find the magic leader, even a good man, which we certainly would want, but that we're going to elect some kind of a dictator or a king, if you will, and he'll produce all the prosperity and all the economic prosperity and all the great ideas and so forth, is a foolish concept. It starts at the most basic level, which is the individual. And you do get the government that you deserve, and we will deserve it if we are as individuals, if we are strong as individual family units and as individuals.
Bill, I would like to tell you a story about my own experience in the legislature. I actually had a man, a constituent, call me on the phone, and he explained to me that he is getting paid by the government to babysit his grandchildren. And he only gets paid to babysit them 3 days a week, and he feels he should get paid to babysit them 5 days a week, but the government only pays him for 3 days a week. And he was trying to explain to me that if only he got paid for babysitting them more, then the mom would be out working more. And this is his unmarried daughter living with him, by the way. I can't believe we've come to that point where we're paying grandparents to watch their grandchildren. I did say, you know what? There are some parents who will babysit their grandchildren for free. But we have got things so turned upside down. The other question I would have liked to have asked is why the father of the children is not taking care of his children. So we have to look at the big picture of what we have done to ourselves. And this generational problem has actually created an idea where women can give birth to children who apparently have no dad. Of course, biologically, that's impossible. I would say we need to be more intelligent than this and ask, is this really what we want as a society?
Cynthia, I'll tell you something. You hit on something. The breakdown of family and the like, and family as the primal source of authority as such. And certainly there's always the situations where, you know, somebody may end up being a single parent for, you know, there's an accident or something like that. So I'm not railing against that. But a big problem has been the sexual revolution in the United States. It was not that long ago when the ideals of virginity were upheld, at least as a societal standard, maybe not in practice, but at least as a societal goal. It was not that long ago. I remember it even in of my youth as still being an idealistic goal. And but with the onslaught of, we'll call it, the Playboy generation, and the again, the idea of immediacy, immediate gratification, and the like, and removing sex from something that is, it's going to produce children, it's going to be part of a family situation, and moving into what I'll call entertainment. It's a recreation. Has really wrecked America. It really has wrecked America. It has made young men irresponsible. It used to be, you know, the old idea that, listen, I don't want my daughter dating anyone unless they have a job and a responsible man and the like, and families kind of guarded their daughters and so forth. But with the ease of casual sex and the like, I think it has removed men from the first estate and it's turned them into a bunch of drones and irresponsible as such. Certainly there are responsible people today, but the overall influence has done that. Easy divorce has done that. Yes, are there situations where divorce unfortunately happens, of course. But again, the idea of throwaway marriage, we're just, you know, I'm not finding myself anymore. I hear people say that. I go, what? That's a reason to wreck your family? And with it comes all types of social ills. And who comes to the rescue? It's big government. But very few people realize is that some of the original communist precepts going back into the 1800s, and there were communities that were communal and the like, or based on socialistic communist ideas, the concept of free sex was there. And the idea that sex should be classless, that only the elite are getting the most beautiful women and the like, and then we need to break down that type of social strata and all that, and free and open sex. It actually originated in original communist thought. And sure enough, over the last 130 years and so forth, it has permeated itself into our society and into our thinking and the like. The fruits have been bad. And we can debate all the different points and so forth, but, you know, an important thing in all areas of life is to step back and say, is this working? If it's not working, then something's wrong. And it's obvious that with the social ills that we see today, across America in so many different fashions, it's not working. And so we need to step back and say, what does work?
They're trying to push women to the front of the birth control debate and make it sound like women are demanding government programs pay for free birth control. But behind that, there are also plenty of men who want to make sure women can get on the pill. So,
well, you know, I mean, there are... women's rights, let's touch that for a moment. Women are intelligent. Women are co-equal in the fact that they're in the image of God and the like. A successful entrepreneurial woman, I'm not threatened by that. I think it's a wonderful thing. But the idea, equal pay for equal work and the like, all right? But we've gone to the stage to where the responsibility of both sexes has been thrown right down the toilet. It really has. Why should I have to pay for birth control for someone? When truth of the matter is that this is a personal choice. How do you pay for people's personal choices? Right? Well, I sure would like it that, you know, I like going out to the Dodger game. Maybe I should get a subsidy for that because I just enjoy going to the Dodgers and watching them play. All right. So there needs to be personal responsibility. Again, personal sovereignty and the like. Not all things have to be part of the social drama that everyone supports everyone. And where is this... tree that, you know, the money tree can produce that. It's just moving money around from one person to another. All right? Somebody has to pay for this. And, you know, we're paying it to ourselves. There has to be personal accountability, personal responsibility, and we cannot just diffuse everything off to the general society. It doesn't make any sense.
And since you mentioned the Los Angeles Dodgers, I will remind you that my husband grew up in California, and the Dodgers was his favorite team also. Then we moved to St. Louis, and of all shocks, the Rams moved to St. Louis. So,
oh, don't get me going on that. If I can give a little story, a little less serious here. I love the Los Angeles Rams when they were here, and Coach George Allen and old Roman Gabriel and the like. And they never won a Super Bowl for us here in Los Angeles. They moved to St. Louis, but I was still rooting for them. And second year there, they won the Super Bowl, and I was kind of excited until, if I can pick on her, Georgia Frontieri came to accept the trophy from the NFL commissioner. And she said, she held up the trophy, and here's what she said. She said, "I guess we did the right thing by moving to St. Louis and getting out of Los Angeles." And I had an epiphany moment, and my great love for the Rams has now turned to hatred. I felt betrayed. It was such a betrayal, although I did like Kurt Warner and the like. But it was such a betrayal that my dear Los Angeles Rams, who I held so close to my heart, said they were glad they were out of Los Angeles. So I hope we can get an NFL franchise someday. But here's the thing. Let me move this back to a little serious topic. Sports franchises are going and having municipalities pay to build these stadiums. Since when should public money be used to support a private enterprise? Let these NFL teams pay for their own facilities. All right, and quit trying to put this onto the public. The public does not have an interest, a true interest anyway, in having a sports franchise in their city. Since when should that be part of the public domain? Since when is that an essential service of government to build sports stadiums? And so that's one of the reasons why Los Angeles does not have an NFL franchise, is because they want to have the city of Los Angeles or surrounding community come up with $1 billion to $2 billion to build a deluxe sports stadium. And we have the Los Angeles Coliseum, it would work fine, but this is ridiculous with the luxury boxes and the like. And again, this idea that a pastime like football or baseball should be supported by the public trust. I think it's a ridiculous concept, and I say this as a person who is a contributing editor to the official book of Major League Baseball called Total Baseball. I was a contributing editor. I love sports, enjoy them, enjoy it as an art form, if you will. But the public trust, the public funding of this is just, it's abhorrent. It has no place.
Well, let me explain to you the other side of the coin from having been in the legislature. It is very common for the lobbyists to offer tickets to the Rams game or the Cardinals game, and not just tickets in the seating area, but they always have been tickets in the box suites with all the food and all the fun. That was one of the things that always amazed me when I'd go to one of those games, is people really weren't paying any attention to the game. And actually, those who were watching it on the TV monitor. There were a few people who would watch the game, but that was one of my husband's greatest frustrations, is we're going to watch a professional game and tickets are over $100 and nobody's watching the game. You could see it better at home.
I've experienced that as well, and I've been in a luxury box. And they're just really kind of social gatherings.
Yeah, they
by
are.
By people who aren't really true sports fans. I really didn't enjoy the experience, to be honest with you.
Well, you understand.
What I've really found is that the best fans are sitting in the cheap seats, mm-hmm. and eating a hot dog. And that is where the real reality is. So, again, sports has been moved into a whole entertainment venue. The you take, for instance, the Super Bowl. You know, they got to have Beyonce or, Janet Jackson or something doing a halftime show. I don't have any idea what this has to do with football. And or you throw in the whole titillation of cheerleaders and the whole thing and to try to make it into this bombastic experience. I don't know whatever happened to a marching band at halftime, right? But what has happened is a whole centrality that is surrounding Hollywood, it's surrounding professional sports and surrounding other activities, it's not healthy. It's a sensuality that has moved sports away from, again, a character building experience to help develop your body and to develop a discipline and that type of thing. It's moved into, this whole arena of sensuality. And we find that in so many areas of life. Cheap entertainment, bread and circuses and so forth. You know, the Romans went this way, and it's really important to study how great empires have risen and have fallen. And we have tipped over to the other side to where we've become prurient and sensualized and so forth. When Rome started moving into, you know, gladiator games and bread and circuses and the like, it was on the way to decline. And so these are telltale signs. Human nature has not changed over time. Our technology has improved, but the base of our souls has not changed. And so are we any different than the Romans? Absolutely not. Not in that regard. And we need to take the lessons of history, and we're not.
Yeah, it horrified me to see that they were showing videos of our journalists being beheaded. I don't know who wants to watch that. It brings out the worst in us. I couldn't look. I wanted to stay up with the news, but do we really want to see blood and guts all over the place? So how old are you, Bill?
I'm 57 years old, born right at the peak of the baby boomers at 1957. So I've seen a lot of change in America in my short lifetime. And Cynthia, what's interesting, I remember the early 60s. We had, just in my lifetime, we had coins that were made out of silver. My lunch money, I got a silver quarter to have lunch, all right? We went from crew cuts and Letterman's jackets and malt shops in 1963-64, we went to Woodstock, long hair, hippies, and LSD, and burned the bra. And it happened in about 5 or 6 years. Something happened in the 1960s. I've had many people ask me, when do you think the turning point occurred? And I think 1964 was a very pivotal year. We had... We changed our currency over from a basically gold-silver-based backing, at least of some sort, fractional reserve at least, to this clad coinage, you know, fake coinage, if you will. We had the beginning of the Vietnam War. We had the assassination of John F. Kennedy, and I could pick on John F. Kennedy for certain things, but he represented youth and at least what they called Camelot, to the United States. We had this assassination. It was a great shock to our country. And if I can add this, it seems kind of funny now looking back on it, but we had the Beatles. And they seemed kind of mellow and calm at the time, the little mop hair dudes and Ed Sullivan Show and whatnot. But it was quite a shock socially to America. And within a few years, you had John Lennon and Yoko Ono posing naked in bed, you know, smoking pot and the like, and it was terrible examples for a whole generation. And we had a pivotal turn in 1964. We got rid of prayer in schools in the early 1960s. We had, the emergence of what they'll call the Playboy culture and looser morals and all that. The 60s, we're still paying the price. We've gone downhill since the 1960s. That is the pivotal turning point as such. You know, simply as late as 1968, we had a balanced budget in the United States, federal government. In 1968-69, fiscal year, we actually had a balanced budget. Isn't that amazing?
Today, people talk about the importance of having a balanced budget, but I'm opposed to that because I've studied it close enough to know that that's the worst thing we could do for ourselves if we told Congress, now the budget has the balance, what they would do is have a valid reason to raise our taxes. It really concerns me because they could say, well, we have to have a balanced budget, so now everybody's going to pay 80% without a cap on spending. I love the idea of having a balanced budget, but the people who want to oppress the citizens are going to use it as a sledgehammer against us.
Listen, this is an interesting topic, okay? It is okay to have a deficit in budget. Now, I know a little run contrary to some of our friends in the Constitution Party, but hear me out. Certain projects, if they're profitable, very few government projects are ever profitable. All right, I'll give you an example of profitable government projects. The Hoover Dam. Hoover Dam was built in the Great Depression, and deficit spended and so forth, but the amount of economic benefit from Hoover Dam far outweighs the cost. It's like buying a house or buying tools for a business and so forth. If you have to go in a little debt to do that, I'm not against that. A car for, a reasonable car for transportation so that you can have a job. That can make some sense. Or a house. The San Francisco Golden Gate Bridge. All right? And there's not a problem, but it has to be something that is going to bring more economic benefit than it does cost. Unfortunately, most government programs do not provide a greater return than their economic cost. All right, there has to be a degree of flexibility with currencies and so forth. We had to go into a deficit to win World War II. There's no way we were going to maintain a balanced budget and fight World War II. All right, it wasn't going to happen. It could not operate that way. So I understand your point. Right. On the other side, though, we must have a cap on taxes. We cannot have this willy-nilly thing where we will kill the goose that lays the golden egg. Economic author Arthur Laffer has shown conclusively through many, many studies that 20% is about the maximum that you can take out of a society. You know, you can tax anywhere from 1% to 100%, correct? Well, if you tax at 100%, people will stop working. They'll just simply stop. All right? So where on this continuum from 1% to 100%, does the government get the most amount of money available? It is right around 20%. Even Joseph in the Bible knew that the maximum he could take out of the Egyptian society during the years of plenty was 20%. And they stuck the grain in the warehouse and so forth. Well, right now, receipts for government at all levels, with sales tax, property tax, income tax, state tax, it's pushing towards the 40% range. It's ridiculous. In government, if they would cut taxes, if government would cut taxes, they would actually end up with more revenue. I know that sounds contrarian in many ways, but it's true. Under John F. Kennedy, taxes were cut and revenues increased. Under Ronald Reagan, taxes were cut from tax rates, marginal tax rates as high as 75%, cut down to 28%. And guess what happened, Cynthia?
What?
Revenue went up for the government, all right? And so it's about time the government wakes up and realizes that, hey, there's a limit. There's an absolute limit. And once that limit is reached, if as I propose, a 20% tax rate, that you must live within your means. You must live within your means within normal times. So that's just the simple economics of it. And what I'm very fearful of is if you look at social Europe, you know, very socialist type of situations there, they're actually proposing municipalities and the member states that are in terrible shape just simply confiscating people's savings account. In other words, a 10% tax on what you have in savings. It is unbelievable, the thirst and desire for government. Realize government is a beast, and it has an unquenchable thirst for more money, because why? You need to have more power. You've been in the political system. You understand how it works, that your largesse and what you can promise to people, it requires money. And so to stay in office and so forth, it's fed by the mechanism of government spending. All of this must change. Career politicians, we've got to get rid of that system. There should definitely be term limits. The original founding fathers, these were citizen politicians. They served a couple terms, went back to their states and their farms and their businesses and worked in that fashion. Career politicians are going to definitely be in a situation where they're going to demand more and more of the largesse of the people so they can maintain more and more power. It is simply a system that's it's going to fall apart.
What you're explaining sounds very simple and easy to understand, yet apparently the voters keep putting people in office who spend more and more. I was in a Republican state legislature. I had a Republican governor, and there was a Republican House and a Republican-controlled Senate. And even with that, the budget continued to grow. So let me give you my summary. It doesn't matter who's in power, the budgets still keep getting bigger. It's that the Republicans and Democrats disagree on where to spend the money, but the amount has never been debated. So both Republicans and Democrats agree to spend money, but they have different ideas of where it should be spent.
But, well, now listen, I sung the praises of Ronald Reagan about cutting taxes, and it did improve revenue. Unfortunately, Ronald Reagan, though, was the highest deficit spending president to get this whole thing going along. Up to its time, he ran unbelievable budget deficits. And so he had one side of the equation correct. I'll move this to a little bit of a different direction. When I ran for Congress, I ran it on a shoestring, as most third-party candidates do. My opponents both spent, now this is for a congressional race, mind you, well over $2 million apiece for this one congressional district in that election. It's amazing. Cynthia, in 1980, just 34 years ago, the average congressional candidate only spent $30,000 to $40,000 for a campaign. It has escalated from $30,000 to $40,000 to an average of about $2 million for a campaign. All right. How, again, can we have citizen representation when it is moved into the realm of the wealthy and to how much money can be spent and so forth? And money is a great corruptor. It is a great corruptor wherever it's found. I mean, even in churches, money can often corrupt there as well. And so it is a very powerful force that must be very well managed. But we've moved this away from the common citizen into big money and big power. And so how can big money and big power ever represent, everyday Joe America? It cannot. It cannot. And it's been a great corruptor. And it also creates a disconnect between government and its people.
So
we're seeing an interesting movement around the world. We're seeing Scotland, which today I believe is when the election is, trying to break away. You'll see even in Spain, in Catalonia, they're talking about voting to break away and so forth. And that's because instinctually people are realizing that big government doesn't represent them. There are about 10 different areas around the world that are talking about independence movements and so forth. Here in California, there's actually an amendment that's trying to be put on the ballot to turn California into six states. And, of course, there's certain secessionist ideas across our country, you know, of forming regional new governments and the like. These are not serious movements, I think, at this time. But we're going to see this over the coming future, a natural reaction. They may not totally understand why, but the people are realizing around the world that big government does not represent them. And it's a natural reaction of this idea of breaking this into smaller pieces and smaller parts. I don't like that idea. I would prefer that we remain whole, wherever they are. I would prefer Scotland to be with England. But there's a problem with big government. Let's fix it. Let's fix the big government so that people don't feel that the only recourse is they have to go and spin off.
Well, Bill, you've done a fabulous job of identifying the problems, but now I want to hear your solutions. How do we get out of this mess we're in? Share with us the path. Be Moses for 1 minute and lead us. What do we do now?
We are made in the image of God. We are made in the image of God. What a fantastic potential that is. We are joint heirs with Christ. We are inheritors of all things, the entire universe. I go out the back door and I like to look at the great starry sky out here we have in Menifee. What an amazing potential that every single human being has. We must come to realize who we are as individuals and our great human potential. That is where it starts. All right. It's not going to, you cannot legislate morality. You cannot legislate common sense. You cannot legislate enlightenment. You cannot legislate spirituality. It has to start with the individual. And we must be seekers at all levels. We must be asking, who am I? Why was I born? What purpose do I serve? Is there a creator? Does he have a plan for me? Is there a plan for the universe? And if we're not asking those types of questions, and we are indulgent personalities to where whatever it is, we just seek whatever can tickle our nerves and tickle our eyes and tickle our lusts. If we live a life that is based upon those premises, we will fail. But we must seek the higher calling and ask the bigger questions. And the important thing, too, is individuals, and this is what builds a great country. Realize that they came to the United States. There's a difference. North America and South America, let's take the examples. South America has all the resources and things that the North America had, but the destiny has not been quite as great. And the reason is people came to America, for the most part, to seek God. A few sought gold, but most sought God and religious freedom, and to be able to find that sovereignty between a man and his maker. South America, on the other hand, was exploited mostly by people seeking gold and not God. The difference is the letter L, just the letter L between gold and God. And there's a great difference in our destinies because of that. Well, we've lost that first estate. And again, as individuals, we must be seekers. We must ask the grand questions of life. And if you're not asking the grand questions of life, well, you're going to have a miserable end. And I don't think you'll find true happiness and joy in life as well. So there's great benefits in the here and now. But this is where we must start, is, again, find a spiritual rejuvenation. The unfortunate fact is, I'm afraid, Cynthia, that we'll have to have a little bit more aversion therapy. Usually people do not cry out and seek this enlightenment and spiritual path unless there's pain first. That seems to be the unfortunate way of man. I hope that we can avoid that pain, but unfortunately I feel that we're ahead for a little bit more aversion therapy, if you will, before we start asking the right questions. But asking the right questions of life is where it all begins. It trickles up, and it will go up into the economy and go up into the political system and the like. But it starts with us as individuals. At least for us as individuals, let us start with our own homes and move it up.
That's a good word. Thank you, Bill. What kind of church do you attend?
I'm a fundamentalist, sola scriptura type of individual, and take the Bible very literally.
Are you hearing? Let me ask you, Bill. Are you hearing this from your pulpit, or is it something you came up with on your own?
I do hear it from my own pulpit. I have the opportunity to actually teach from the pulpit on occasion and so forth. So I do definitely try to make that part of my message. But I am associated with people that I do believe have the similarity and vision and faith for what I've already conveyed here to you.
And maybe we can make that an encouragement to our listeners, because there are a lot of people who are listening to our show who believe in what you and I are talking about, but they've not found a church that resonates with those values. It's very hard in some places to even find a church that will take on the moral issues. They like to talk about good, you know, things that make people feel good. And a lot of churches talk about the importance of putting money in the offering plate. But I would encourage everybody to find a church that resonates with our worldview. What is your advice?
Well, let me tell you something. Christianity has had an evolution. It has had an evolution over time from what it originally started out as, which was a community, a brotherhood. That is how it originally started out. Tended to be smaller groups, median homes and the like. When the Greeks got a hold of Christianity, they kind of turned it into a philosophy. And from there, when the Romans got a hold of Christianity, they turned it into a political system. And here in America, when we got a hold of it, we've turned church into a business model. All right? So there's been an evolution away from what we'll call primitive Christianity, which again was about that the highest calling is yourself, to use the Spirit of God to overcome oneself, to have the freedom, not just of the grace of God, which we have the forgiveness of our sins, but to be able to realize that we are called to be members of the kingdom of God. And that's a kingdom. It's a political system, if you will, if you think about that, right? Jesus Christ is the king, and we will be there as teachers and administrators and so forth. I've come to prepare many offices for you. So we have a high calling to leadership, and we need to realize that. But again, we've got the churches today, if I can generalize, and I'm not picking on any one church in particular, but it has become another form of entertainment, another form of entertainment venue. Are there exceptions to this? Of course. But I'm talking in generality. We can pick on the 501c3 and how it has made churches impotent. Cynthia, the great movements here in America, where did they originate? Did they originate with government, or did they originate in the church? The Revolutionary War and the concepts of that freedom, where did it originate? It originated in churches. Where did the abolitionist movement that spoke out against the great evils of slavery, where did it originate in? It didn't come from government. It came from churches. How about the civil rights movement and the equality of races and that type of thing, the great injustices that were being done? Where did that originate? It started in the churches. It didn't start with government. All right? So if there's to be a spiritual revival in America, if there's to be just a physical revival in America, we need to find that heartbeat in the churches today. But where are they? Where are the marches? Where are those that are crying aloud and sparing not? They're very rare and hard to find. And I'm very disappointed about that. We, as individuals, we must not seek to hear the smooth things. We must not seek that. We must hear the hard things. And all of us must take on that discipline of taking on the hard things in our life and to hear the hard things. And sure, there's joy and there's fellowship and those things. I don't want to sound stern here. But we must have in our heart inspirational dissatisfaction. Inspirational dissatisfaction. And from that is where productive actions and courses will arise. We need to find that in our churches. We need to find the inspirational dissatisfaction so that we can go forward to be stalwarts in our community and in business and all other areas of our life. That is where we've got to find it. I'm not seeing it quite that much.
Nor am I. But thank you, Bill. You have been inspirational. I love talking to you. And out of respect for your time, I know you have to go. But since we're running out of time, would you be willing to come back and be on our show again sometime?
Oh, I absolutely would enjoy that, Cynthia. And you are just a delight. I appreciate all that you've been doing with the Constitution Party and the great example that you are here in the state of Missouri and nationally as well. Love your energy. You have great energy. I can hear it in your voice. And thank you very much for the opportunity to have been with you here today on Homefront.
Great. We'll talk to you later then. Thanks, Bill.
Take care, Cynthia. Bye-bye.
This has been another edition of Homefront on Missouri Grassroots Radio. I'm Cynthia Davis and hope you enjoyed our program. Please join us next week when we offer another infusion of truth, honesty, and solutions that will grow people bigger and shrink government smaller. Thank you for joining us. See you next week.